Clubhouse.
I had to kill you. I'm really sorry.
There is a lot of content in the world. Each year, we're inundated with thousands of hours of television, hundreds of new movies, and music every week. It can be overwhelming. How do you know what's worth your time and what you should just skip? Well, luckily, Pod Clubhouse is here to help.
Welcome to Love It or Leave It, the podcast. Tonight, we're talking about Killing Eve. My name's Mike, and joining me tonight is Dani Dudik. She is a pop culture impresario. She is the ATX gossip. She is everywhere and a frequent member of the Clubhouse. How you doing, Dani? Thanks for joining us tonight.
I'm good. Hi, how are you?
Good, good, good. I'm so excited to talk about this show. When you said, you know, can we talk about it? I was like, hell yeah. You know, it's been a while since I've gotten actually to really kind of jaw about the show with anyone. So I'm super excited to talk about Killing Eve.
Me too.
Well, let's do some preliminaries. How are you handling the New World Order?
Well, I'm getting really caught up on a lot of TV shows, so that's great.
You know, it's true. I feel like I'm actually not nearly as caught up as I should be. Like, I'm still hearing all the time, have you watched this yet? Have you binged this yet? I'm like, no. But I really want to turn to movies. I feel like I'm neglecting a lot of movies that I should probably be watching. Especially, you know, like Tribeca Film Festival has their online exhibits going right now. And so that's something that is on my to-do list to start jumping into. Yeah, but I don't feel like I'm taking quite advantage. I'm not super sexy skinny yet. You know, I haven't lost the 97 pounds that I wanted to lose in this quarantine. I haven't caught up on all of the pop culture I want to. So I don't think I'm doing quarantine great. I think I'm failing at quarantine.
Well, I'll tell you why I'm better at catching up on the TV instead of the movies. Now, not necessarily with this show, but with a lot of shows, I don't have to fully pay attention. So I can have it on in the background while I'm working, and maybe I'll miss something here and there and I jump back, but I can do two things at once. However, when I'm watching a movie, I tend to need to put everything down, and that's been my struggle. I'm doing a lot of things at once right now. So that lends itself to me watching a series.
I agree with you. I actually had the same feeling. If I'm watching a movie and I find myself like on my phone or doing this or walking around or folding laundry, it takes me forever to get through the damn thing because I have to stop and rewind. I can't just let it go by. Whereas a lot of TV series, I can just kind of have it on the background. You're 100% correct with that.
Man, that's exactly what happened to me. Like two Fridays ago, I went to watch the Downton Abbey movie because I hadn't seen it. And it took me 4 to 5 hours to watch it.
Listen, the struggle is real. I mean, there are certain shows that take me forever to watch them because I'm taking notes or I'm really paying attention. Like Westworld is a good example. You know, we're going to be recording Westworld. Well, not you and I, but I will be recording Westworld later today. And I have to put aside like 3 hours to get through the fucking thing because I stop it. I rewind it. I stand up and I stare at my TV screen. I get up like nose close to my TV to make out like the little Easter eggs in the back. It takes me forever to get through those shows.
Yeah, so. I feel you.
Oh, man. All right. Well, we're here not to talk about Westworld, even though we should, or movies. We're here to talk about Killing Eve. So Killing Eve, just a little background in case people aren't aware, is actually based on originally a series of novellas, four novellas called the Codename Villanelle series by Luke Jennings. The four novellas were put together into a book. And then since then, he's actually come out with two sequels. Pretty much right before season two and then season three dropped, Luke Jennings released a new sequel book also. Other than the kind of main protagonists, the books, from what I understand, I haven't read them. They're actually pretty different. But they're there, and it's definitely the source material. And I think it's always important to note the source material, especially when you're dealing with like a spy show or a thriller show, just because the comparisons get made so often. I was a fan of the show from like the word get-go, and I really paid attention at the beginning. And back in 2018, if we can remember that far, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Fleabag wasn't a thing yet. I think season one was out at the time, but not a lot of people were aware of who she was. You know, Solo came out that year where she was the robot that eventually became the Millennium Falcon's brain. You know, Phoebe Waller-Bridge had a great year in 2018. And Killing Eve, she's like the mastermind behind it. She adapted it for television. When did you first become aware of Killing Eve?
So I'm really late to the game here. It's one of those shows where you've got it on the back burner, like, oh yeah, I need to watch that show. I need to watch that show. So for me, it was really the awards season following season one. And Sandra Oh was just being talked about and obviously started bringing in all these awards. And so then every time an award show would be on, I'm like, oh, I got to watch that show. And then somehow I would just forget about it. So then in this quarantine, I was really looking for something that I could sink my teeth into. And it just popped up in my head. And I said, oh my gosh, I've got to watch Killing Eve. And so I just started it about 2 weeks ago. And I'm completely caught up and watching the new season.
That's as good as an entry point as it is, because this show has been nominated for literally every award. The show itself, obviously Jodie Comer and Sandra Oh, Fiona Shaw, the sound design, the costume design, the music score. The show has been nominated since it aired pretty much in England for every award possible, and it has won a ton of them. It's been nominated for Emmys. It's been nominated for SAGs, for Golden Globes, for Gotham Awards. It won the Peabody Award for Best Long-Form Drama or something like, you know, like, this show has just been accolade after accolade. If you're not aware, let's go through like a kind of a quick synopsis. I'll give a rundown, and then Danny, if I missed anything, you can kind of fill in the blanks for me. Because the show is...
Sounds good.
It is two seasons in. This is not a hot new show that we're talking about, but it's definitely a show that is best watched, I think, bingeable. It airs weekly, but I think it's really best digested in a binge format. So essentially, you have Sandra Oh plays an MI5 agent named Eve Pilastri. She is the titular Eve. She is kind of obsessed with female assassins. She's also a little bit nosy, and she eventually oversteps the boundaries and gets fired from her MI5 job. MI5 is like the British version of like the FBI. Luckily for her, her obsession into female assassins coincides with a secret group at MI6, which would be like the British version of our CIA. She gets recruited by Fiona Shaw's character, whose name is Carolyn Martins, into this like little side pocket group of MI6 that is tracking this international female assassin only known as Villanelle. Villanelle is played by Jodie Comer. Season one basically spends the time being kind of a cat and mouse game, where Villanelle becomes aware of Eve Pilastri and becomes more than a little obsessed with her. She realizes there's this woman, Eve, who is as smart as she is, who understands how she operates, and it piques her interest in a really interesting way. It's very, who's tracking who? She's not quite obsessed with Eve in season one, but she's definitely consumed with her. You know, she's married to Owen McDonald, who plays a guy named Nico Pilastri. And her marriage, which had been happy and kind of well humming along, kind of starts to fall apart and begins to fray as she becomes more and more obsessed. And so you have this cat and mouse spy game, but it's these two really strong female characters kind of chasing and dancing around each other. Season one ends with a kind of climactic confrontation between the two of them. And then season two kind of flips the roles a little bit. You have Eve really becomes more obsessed than Villanelle. And really, I like that. I call season two kind of the descent of Eve Pilastri. She becomes all consumed with Villanelle and trying to think like her and maybe becoming a little too much like her. And now season three has just begun. It aired on April 12th, last night, April 19th. Just the timestamp when we're recording this was episode two of season three. And I'm not going to give anything away for what happened at the end of season two and season three in case you're not caught up. But yeah, it's just kind of like a modern spy versus spy, you know, cat and mouse game. What do you think, Dandy? Did I do a good job? Did I miss anything?
No, I think that was a good explanation. I think the thing about the two female leads that has been really, it's really drawn me in is how complex those characters are. And I don't even know how to put my finger on it because they're not girly. They're not like a girly, a lot of these films and shows, I feel like when you have a female lead, they're still kind of put in this like sexy sex pot spiral. And I don't think that about Villanelle, although she is sexy, of course, as who wouldn't be playing the role she's playing.
For sure.
But they're just, they're such complex characters that I can't say like they're super girly or they're not girly. There's not either of those things. It's almost like you don't think about the fact that they're women. Does that even make sense?
It totally does. Because when I was thinking about it and I was collecting my thoughts for today, the obvious thing is it's like a really great like James Bond spy thriller, but they're women. But, you know, it doesn't actually really matter. It only matters insofar as when the show skewers the expectation of women, and not really so much on the Eve side, but certainly on the Villanelle side, she will often use the assumption of how women are perceived as part of her tool bag. You know, she's a very pretty, you know, young woman. She's very attractive. She's alluring. She's sexy, but she's also kind of dorky and funny. And
she uses that as a weapon. And she's really made a career of getting as close and making these audacious kills that she makes through the use of her sexuality and use of using, it's just a little girl. You know, it's just this simple woman, this tiny woman. What can she do to me? And constantly, that's the final comeuppance for someone. If someone makes that mistake, you know, they're dead in the next scene kind of thing. And I like how it kind of, it turned the trope on its head of the weak damsel that needs to be saved. There are no damsels in the show. There's three leads in the show are Jodie Comer's Villanelle, Sandra Oh's Eve, and then Carolyn Martin's played by Fiona Shaw. I mean, she's just a goddamn shark. She is this old spy master. She is just vicious and amoral. You know, not immoral, just wants to get the job done. You know, her job is to hunt down spies and kill spies and, you know, protect her country and maybe, you know, wet her beak on the side a little bit. Who knows? But yeah, it's just really strong female characters, but it's definitely not, oh, look, they're women doing a man's job. It's not that at all.
Yeah. I do love when you were talking about Villanelle kind of using that to her advantage. One of my favorite things about the way she's written or personified on the series is when she dresses in a complete contrast to what she'll be doing. So I'm sure you've read about the pink dress that she wore in one very famous scene. And obviously she's like looking very girly and very mm-hmm. pretty. And then she does these very gruesome acts. So it's just like kind of an interesting contrast there. But that year, the awards show red carpet was all pink dresses in the style of this dress she wore. And I thought that also was just so interesting because the character is not even girly, but it's still affecting the world around her. She's affecting the world around her, both in reality and on screen.
You can take that two ways. It's either Hollywood is either reclaiming it, you know, reclaiming pink as not a girly color, but as an empowerment color, or just sheep, you know, who see this really cool character that everyone wants to kind of be like. Because listen, most people, I think if you ask them, are going to say Villanelle is not an easy villain. I mean, she's very likable. She's hard to not like.
Very likable. Yeah.
And so there is definitely this feeling of you want to be like her. But by going out and wearing pink, you know, you could easily see where maybe you're missing the boat on it. You know, she's wearing pink, that pink tutu, almost in a mockery of what someone in a pink tutu should be doing, you know?
Right.
So it's just maybe people missing the boat a little bit. But you made a good point, and I wanted to come back to it. You know, Sandra Oh is not really sexy. And she's very attractive, but she is very dowdy in the show. She is a, what do you call it? Like, she surfs the computer. She's like a paper pusher. She's an analyst at, yeah. you know, at the spy agency. She is not James Bond or Villanelle. You know, she's not out there, you know, a femme fatale, you know, a Nikita kind of thing. Her hair is a mess all the time. She drinks a lot. She eats fatty foods. Like, she's just like a normal person. But when she comes into contact with Villanelle, there is this level of sexiness and danger. There's this explosive chemistry that's just always court between them. And again, it's not about them being women. It's about their chemistry is so animalistic. It makes you link closer to your television because you can smell like the pheromones coming off of them in a like a hunt, like a prey kind of way. They're both the prey. They're both the predator. It's really interesting how the show pulls that off. It always makes me stop and wonder how engrossed I get into the episodes.
Yeah, I agree.
When you watch the show, what stands out to you at the end of an episode? Like when you think back on it, what do you think about really blew your mind in the show?
Well, that's hard to say without giving anything away, but I just think it's just a very well written and produced series, not to mention the acting. But I mean, the way that the show that each episode is put together is why you said it's a good bingeable show, because they end on a note where you want to know what comes next. I mean, even thinking about this season, the end of the first episode, I was like, oh, my gosh, I have to wait now. So every episode, I feel, ends with this cliffhanger. And it doesn't always have to be something incredibly dramatic, but they've done a good enough job setting up that storyline that however it ends, I'm ready for the next episode. like you said, that's the best kind of show to binge because you don't have to wait. But it also is made for the real traditional way of television where you have to wait a week for that next one.
Yeah, I feel like as a culture, we've really lost the ability to wait, you know, why ratings have become so wacky and so hard to follow is because I don't think people have the patience anymore to wait. You know, it's hard. Like when episode one ended of this new season three. Yeah. Hell yeah. You want to go press play on episode two. Like what happened? But that speaks to something else about the show. It's a bold show. It is not afraid to take chances, and it's a dangerous show. You really feel that no one is safe at any given time. You know, back in season one, they killed off Dan, who I'm forgetting his name.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, David Haig, who played Bill Pargrave. It wasn't her boss. It was like her like partner. He was like a mentor. He was a bit older than her, but he's like a pretty famous British actor. He's like a big name that they had in the show. And I was like, oh, this guy is like, he's one of the male leads. And they killed him before halfway through the season. You know, I don't mind spoiling season one because it came out 2 years ago. You know, he is killed in a vicious way in the middle of a crowded nightclub. He is stabbed to death because he got too close to Villanelle. And it was shocking. I can clearly remember sitting here. I was watching the show on screeners and I was like, what the fuck just happened? Like, what happened? It was shocking. And because shows don't do that. But a show that does do that, man, you are creating some loyalty with me because that's a bold show.
I remember the moment that I knew it was going to turn. I mean, it was like he was in that nightclub and he was moving towards her and she hadn't stopped yet. And the minute she stopped and turned around, I literally gasped out loud. I was like, oh my God, no, turn, go. Like I knew what was going to happen.
He fell into the trap that we were talking about earlier. He was this grizzled old spy who had been doing it for years. And he underestimated this young woman's skill set. He thought he was being slick. He thought he was keeping well enough back and that he wasn't being spotted. And she was just dangling him. She was just playing with him like a cat with a mouse in her paws. Yep. And then she unloaded with him. And I just remember being shocked. And people who were watching this season, if you were not caught up, you were going to have a very similar feeling at the end of episode one of season three. I mean, it ended with a splat. You know, not a bang, but it ended with a significant kind of jaw-dropping moment. You know, and really reinforce the idea that no one is safe. What do you think about the kind of character arc and the way they've drawn these characters? Do you feel like you've seen an evolution across the seasons? Because you've recently watched it all together. Right. So you have a pretty fresh memory. What do you think of like Eve at the start versus Eve now, Villanelle at the start versus Villanelle now? How would you describe that to someone?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think in the beginning, I expected to be very drawn to Eve, hence, you know, with the name of the show, knowing who Sandra Oh is. I just thought, okay, so I'm going to be really drawn to this person. And I was and am, but as it went on, and then you talked about season two having a little bit different of a feel, I really found myself wanting to know and see more of Villanelle and cared less about Eve. And now I think I'm turning another corner where now I'm starting to care about Eve again because her life has changed so much. So now it's like, oh, wait, what's happening with her? What's she going to do now? Who's she going to become? Also, Carolyn, you know, you made a comment about her not being immoral. I don't know if I'm sold on that. I feel like maybe there's more for us to learn about her because she's kind of holding her cards close to the vest. So I don't really know still, like, what her full purpose is.
The way she's played, and I think she's played masterfully by Fiona Shaw, who it's crazy to think, you know, she's Aunt Petunia. That's how I see her, you know, from the Harry Potter movies. She plays,
yeah,
you know.
Duh.
But it's kind of crazy to think like the same woman, but you get the feeling that there's never anything off the table for her character. There were plot lines in season two where it unfolded, and at the end of it, she was just kind of like, yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to happen. And it was complex and bloody and hard to think that it would have been orchestrated. But when you look back at it, you could totally see how she was manipulating and kind of pulling strings. Like, she's the ultimate kind of puppet master, especially of Eve. She is largely kind of Eve's handler. even though Eve does tend to go off rogue on her own, you know, you have Fiona Shaw's Carolyn Martins over top of her. Then on the other side, you have on Villanelle's side, you have another great supporting character with Kim Bodnia, who plays Constantine, her old Russian handler. And they have like a real interesting relationship. Have you like, are you a fan of his? I know a lot of people are. I am. What do you think about Constantine as a supporting character in the show?
I don't know if I'm as big of a fan as other people, but maybe it's just because I don't trust him. And then I maybe should like him more because that's intriguing. But I don't know. I don't know how I feel about him. I really actually do want to know more about him and Carolyn's past relationship, though. So I'm hoping they get into that a little bit more this season.
Yeah. Yeah, they've definitely played with it a lot. I mean, he regularly pops up into her house making breakfast. They have hinted strongly that they have had at least a lot of sex, if not a significant relationship. But they're both from the Cold War period. These are, you know, Soviet Union and Margaret Thatcher spies. You know, this is the era that these two are coming out of. So you wouldn't think that they would be as chummy bedfellows. But there is a whole level of the show that has nothing to do about Eve or Villanelle. There is this shadowy factor of the 12 and who is really hiring who and who works for who. It's not just easy to say it's MI6 versus the KGB or the FSB or freelance killers. You know, there is this really other complex level that the show hasn't really delved into. It's dangled it for two seasons now, but hasn't really done a lot with. So I'm curious in season three if we're going to get more of that lore and that mythology, which I think I think you'd get an answer. You would see how Carolyn and Constantine are connected. There's a whole world there, and I feel like we're still only getting a third maybe of the full picture. Sometimes I feel like Eve and Villanelle are very much pawns in a game that they don't even realize they're playing.
Agreed. So. Oh, also, I wanted to tell you the other role that I think of Fiona Shaw, and it is ridiculous that this is what I think of, but she was in Three Men and a Little Lady.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about that. You're absolutely right. That's crazy.
I don't know why that made such an impact on me, but every time I see her in anything, in fact, when she was in Harry Potter, I thought, oh, the lady from Three Men and a Little Lady.
That's very funny. That's very funny. Maybe that role is what inspired her to want to do this role. You know, she snapped maybe a little bit. So did you know, I feel like everyone in America knows Sandra Oh from Grey's Anatomy. It's hard to find someone who didn't watch Grey's Anatomy at some point and love Christina Yang and that character, or at least know who it was. But maybe I shouldn't make that assumption. So are you familiar with Sandra Oh at all?
Yes. Again, because of award shows and tabloids and, you know, that kind of thing, TV show, like, I mean, entertainment TV shows. However, I did not watch Grey's Anatomy until sometime in 2019. I watched about three seasons and then decided, nope, there was a reason I didn't watch this show and gave up on it. But I knew who she was. I knew she was on that show. I knew she was an original cast member. But I've seen her in other things. I know I always think of her from Under the Tuscan Sun, which might be an odd one to remember her from. But I know I've seen her in lots of other movies as well. So yes, I knew who she was, but not the Grey's Anatomy connection for me.
You are pulling out some great connections, these actresses. It's fantastic. I really know her from Grey's. And you know, her time on the show overlapped with the time that I watched the show. I had stopped watching right before they killed Patrick Dempsey's character off, like the season before. I think I had stopped watching it. Spoilers, they killed his character off. it happened like 10 years ago at this point. But yeah, so I knew her from there and yeah, I was a fan. But Jodie Comer was just like this. I don't even think I knew her name. And the only credit that really stands out to me that I would know her from was The White Princess, which was a Starz show from a couple years ago, which actually she was in the year before Killing Eve came out. So she kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, she definitely has an IMDb page and she has a bunch of credits that go back, you know, several years, but mostly in England, it looks like, and not necessarily stuff that we would have seen here. I'm hesitant to ask you because you're going to come out with some movie that I'm not going to make the connection to. But so did you know Jodie Comer at all? Was she just kind of this fresh face delight for you when you saw her?
No, she was a fresh face delight. And I forget. And I did watch The White Princess. And every time I hear that connection, I think, oh, yeah, but I never remember it. But that was a great show, by the way. White Princess and White Queen are both both worth the time as well.
I think I watched a little bit of White Princess, but it didn't stay with me. I'm hesitant to recall any of the details at all. Yeah, I mean, she's so interesting because I think they've made her the much more complex character. I think season two, she was a little flat arc-wise because I think a lot of it was watching Eve come to Villanelle's level, really have to wrestle with her morals or her willing to set aside them in order to get closer to this infatuation, this growing infatuation she had with Villanelle to live life a little bit dangerously. So I think Eve got a lot of the character depth in season two because it showed her kind of descent into, not madness, but descent to the dark side, maybe, as it were. Whereas I think season one really showed you who Villanelle was, which plays into the next thing I wanted to talk about the show was the humor. It not necessarily something, you know, people will think about right away, but this is a black comedy. This is a dark humor comedy that is very funny. Do you find yourself laughing at it? Maybe I'm just weird. Maybe I need to go to therapy.
No. I find myself laughing. And actually, I don't know why I just thought of the scene right before you went into the comedy, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm going to bring it back to comedy in a second. But one of the issues I had with season three is that I feel like they have kind of jumped over her husband because there was a big thing that happened with him at the end of season two that I was waiting for that to be addressed and wasn't really addressed. But to bring it back to the humor, the shot that involves her husband and how someone was killed, I actually thought was funny, and I should not think it was funny. So there is something wrong with me.
I don't think you're wrong at all. I think a lot of Villanelle's, I think a lot of her assassinations and kills that she commits are quite humorous because I think she's amusing herself. I think she really enjoys her job of killing, and not in like a bloodlust way, but in a, this amuses me. This is what makes me kind of chuckle to myself, you know, that I was able to do this or do that. Or, you know, she likes the own irony that she maybe creates in this situation. And I think she was, you know, holding a knife up to Nico, asking him for a recipe. What was the recipe she demanded for him?
Oh, right. Yeah. What was it? Like a goulash or something?
Yeah.
No, it was chicken pot pie, I think.
Yeah, it was very something American. And you know, it was like a knife to his throat. And it was this really serious situation. But she's so ridiculous. And again, she has like a real dork vibe about her.
Well, her best line that I can recall right now, because it's fresh, was in the newest episode when she says, "Upper management sucks."
Yeah. I mean, just so many times you sit there and she has these... She's so fluent in so many languages. It always floors me how she can just kind of come out with the great accents. And really, I mean, she went through a period last season where she used a New Yorker accent. And it was scary how good it was.
It was great.
Some words she said, you know, she like primarily, you know, and the way she like kind of mushes the R, you know, it's just a very New Yorker kind of thing to do. And it was just, it was like, you're a chameleon. But then... she talks sometimes or she speaks sometimes, and she has like this kind of Yakov Smirnoff broken Russian connection to the language. It's just really funny how they play her character, and Jodie Comer just sells it. She has great facial responses. She's always there with the good like facial beat for something that she finds amusing or strikes her odd. You know, she'll turn her head or something, but you know, she gives as good as she gets too. And I think part of the chemistry between her and Eve is kind of that dark humor. You know, the two of them are dealing with a very serious subject, you know, but I don't know, but I'm just assuming maybe you know, you think about the chemistry, and I want to hear what you think of their chemistry. But I think their humor, that when they're together, they actually don't really take each other that seriously when they're close to each other. They're very comfortable with each other, almost intimately, but not quite. How does their chemistry play for you, and how would you describe it?
Okay, well, first, I wanted to say about the accent of Villanelle. I'm always fascinated by an actor who can, one, switch between all those accents, but two, remember that their natural accent is supposed to be Russian when her real accent is from Liverpool. So I'm always fascinated when she's going from, let's say, you know, she obviously has whatever kind of English accent comes from Liverpool, then she's doing a Russian accent, then she's being French, but she has to remember that she's Russian. And then she's switching to, like you said, like New Yorker, And then I can't even imagine how you keep that straight in your head. The fact that you're a Russian when you're not Russian.
Right. And sells it, and sells it in a really believable way. I mean, if you're willing to buy into the conceit that this is a world that exists, and I think the show really does kind of suck you in, you, especially if you watch a couple episodes back to back, you really have to pull yourself out and be like, oh my God, I actually don't live in that world. You know, I'm in upstate New York, or I'm in Austin. I'm not in, you know, Berlin, or, you know, in London, or in a tube somewhere. It really does suck you in. But I have found myself a lot of times thinking after those performances, why isn't she more famous? Why wasn't she more famous before the show? This is like an immense talent that she is putting out there. Like, she has won as many actress awards, I think, as Sandra Oh has, basically. They've split the difference, you know, in different shows. You know, Jodie Comer's won a bunch of the British acting awards. Sandra Oh's won, I think, you know, she won the SAG. I think, you know, Jodie Comer won the Emmy for Outstanding Actress. So they've kind of like neck and neck. Like, she's really holding her own against this established actress.
Yeah, actually, Jodie won the Emmy this year.
Yeah. Right.
Against Sandra Oh.
Right. And, you know, Sandra kind of got the SAG award for it, which, you know, seems kind of like a second place, you know, participation trophy compared to the Emmy. But I think I'm okay with that. You know, like, Jodie Comer's really putting out a goddamn great performance. It's pretty amazing. So, I why isn't she more famous before this? You know, it's crazy that this is her breakout role. Yeah. Talk to me about the chemistry between these two, because I think that's a big selling point, at least for me, watching them interact and dance around each other.
Yeah, and I think it's on a lot of levels. Like I said earlier about these characters being so complex, I feel that same way about the chemistry. It's like I said, you know, Villanelle, I'm stealing this statement from someone else, but she's an anthropology model brought to life. You know, the way that she looks and the way she dresses in these apartments and houses she lives in, the way she decorates, everything about her is like this pristine. Because she's playing a part at all times. And then you have Eve, who we talked about earlier, is very dowdy. She wears grays and blacks and navy. And there's no style to, very rarely is there a lot of style to her clothing. You know, she tends to pull her hair up so it's out of the way and it doesn't distract from anything. So that's the one level of it. And then on the other level of this cat and mouse game, even I, as a viewer, am like, I'm not really sure what's going on here. Like, I know that there's the fascination, but is there some kind of attraction? There obviously is an attraction for one person has made her attraction clear. But then is Eve attracted back to Villanelle? Because it sure seems like it sometimes, but then at other times it doesn't. So, but that is a testament to how good of actors they are as well as the show being written extremely well, is that I'm never quite sure what's happening between these two people. And like you said, the cat and mouse, like it tends to switch, which is great. And I'm excited to see what happens in season three now that they're at some point going to come face to face again. I want to see who's in charge. How they react, what kind of game each of them play, because they are definitely going to be playing some kind of game.
I think they're always playing a game. And, you know, sometimes it's a psychological game. Sometimes it's a sexual game. Sometimes it's just a straight up cops and robbers, you know, murderer and policewoman, you know, spy catcher game. But they're always playing games. These two are never being straight with each other. Not really. They're also never really being straight with anyone else, though, in your, you know, your life. You were talking about Kim Bodnia's Constantine before and not being sold on him and not liking him as much as maybe other people do. And also Carolyn Martin's, you know, is she amoral? Is she immoral? Is she Satan in a pantsuit? There are no good people. None of the core leads in this show are good people. I think you're dealing with a range of gray, like mid-dark gray to black. You know, I think there are a couple of good people, but they are very much side characters in the show and people you kind of come up against and come around and who get chewed up by the core cast. They get chewed up and they kind of get spit out, or maybe they get suffocated, or maybe they get thrown off of buildings, or maybe, you know, they get stabbed in nightclubs, you know, like the good mm-hmm. people get chewed up like they're getting fitted into like a chipper, a wood chipper. The show is about bad people. It's just how bad are they?
But see, in the beginning, I don't think because I just came off of watching all of it together, I think in the beginning, you didn't know that about Eve. Eve was the good person That's kind of how it was set up, in my opinion. Then she changed, which is what we were saying about like watching the evolution of these characters. Because I think in the beginning, they wrote her as she was the good person and she thought she was the good person.
Yeah, I know. And I think the way season three is starting, I think it's almost like she is coming off of a bender, like a season two long bender of being the bad person. And mm-hmm. she's taking stock of, she's in a bad place at the start of season three. And I think she's really taking stock of how much the living La Vida Loca that she did in season two cost her. But it's interesting. I think you're right. I think season one starts and she is the good person. But with the quickness with which her marriage begins to kind of fall apart because she really begins to ignore her husband. You know, like, I'm not a fan of his, but he's definitely long-suffering in the television trope of marriages. He was kind of there and really being supportive through a lot of stuff and taking a lot. I mean, she was taking a lot of work home and going off on trips and lying to him pretty much from the get-go in season one about what she was doing. Now, maybe she was telling herself it was to keep him safe or so he wouldn't worry, but maybe it was because she was kind of already developing this fascination, this unhealthy fascination with this female assassin. So I think you're right. I think season one starts with Eve being the quote unquote good person and definitely thinking she's the good person, but it didn't take very much nudging of Villanelle and Villanelle's attention to her, reciprocal attention back to her, to kind of flip that switch. There's a scene in season two where she is talking to Nico in the house and they're sitting down to dinner and the doorbell rings. And you probably remember this scene. She goes outside and it's a box of flowers that spell out Eve in the box. Do you remember the scene?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And she touches her face in like a really unconscious kind of way. And like she rubs her neck and it's very intimate as she sees this. And she leaves the box on the stoop outside. She goes in. She comes back into their dining room and she's like, let's go upstairs because she just wants to fuck. Like, she's so turned on by this attention from Villanelle that she just needs to go bang her husband. That's not being a good person. Like, that is someone who is really bought into the dark side. But there's a lot of that. It's almost like she had a penchant for drinking and Villanelle was just a bartender just setting her up. You know, like she wanted to do it. She just didn't know she wanted to do it.
Oh, that's a good call. Yeah.
It's really interesting. That's where her great character development has come from. Her constantly wrestling with how far is too far and can she even tell how far is too far anymore? You know?
Right.
It costs her a lot at the end of season two. You know, she crosses lines that you can't uncross because she gets so sucked up into Villanelle's world. Whereas Villanelle's just kind of like, this is how we are. We're the same. You know, we kill. Like, you're me. I'm you. I'm the only thing that makes you interesting. Like, we're, you know, she's making this pitch for, you know, soulmates.com with Eve. And Eve wakes up one day and it's just kind of like, shit, like she is the only one that really kind of gets me, maybe. I don't know. It's really interesting how they've kind of drawn them all.
Yeah.
When we did Beecham House together, one thing that you and I both really agreed on was how beautiful the show looked. And shooting in India really almost made it a character in the show. So I want to talk about the filming here. I'm going to name some of the places that the show is filmed in. Obviously, it films all over London, but it has filmed in Tuscany, Paris, Berlin, Bucharest, Romania. This season, it's filming in Barcelona. Season three, we're seeing a lot of Barcelona shots. When you watch the show, is that lost on you, or are you aware of the location shoots as you go through it?
I am more aware of things that are related to Villanelle, as I already mentioned. So when I think of those places, I think of the houses she was in. So I don't notice when they're out in the streets as much. I think maybe I'm too into the storyline, but I can think of her Paris apartment. I can think of that house she's living in now in Barcelona. I think of that house in Florence with the guy that she killed. So, but again, I think the reason I'm remembering those things is the contrast, because they're these really gorgeous, like fancy, like everything in my life is perfect settings. And then something very not perfect happens there.
That's interesting. I think you might have hit the nail on the head for me, because I think I noticed the same things you did. But it's really it's almost like the pink tutu and then committing violent acts in it. It's the juxtaposition that she's in these palatial, you know, she'll break into a palatial estate and then murder someone with a hair clip, you know, in a violent, violent way. Like, the show doesn't shy away from the blood or the violence. It really leans into it hard, but it does serve as such an interesting juxtaposition to the beautiful kind of landscape or palatial homes that so much of it takes into. You know, the big murder that happens that she commits towards the end of season two takes place in the largest dining room I have ever seen in my life. You know, with kind of crazy. So it is an interesting juxtaposition how these things that should be pristine, almost museum-like, and it's just splattered in blood and gore, and it's just visceral. But it makes me feel something, though. I don't know that I would have the same reaction if she slits a throat or something in like a seedy apartment as maybe I do in such a
state. It's a character. I think those settings are characters in themselves for the exact reason we both just mentioned.
I thought of this. This is a curveball because I did not prep you for this before. So I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit. If you can, and if you could think of one, what would be your favorite Villanelle assassination? Because this is the kind of show where you can really rank best Villanelle kills. It's almost like a bloody video game, you know, best execution moves. Does one stand out as being a favorite of yours?
What, does one stand out as being a favorite of yours? Maybe you should start since this is your question.
I think if push comes to shove, the one that I think about maybe the most is with the old Italian guy at the birthday party where he thinks that she is like a sex present that's been delivered to his room. And she ends up stabbing his eyeball out and puncturing his brain with a long hair clip she had in her hair. Again, it played with the expectation of what this pretty woman is capable of. You know, she's no threat to me. She's obviously here as like a sex toy. And then he's dead 5 minutes later. I love that. I never get tired of seeing that kind of play out. And again, it was this gorgeous room. She wraps him in this bedding that I went looking for. It was so freaking sexy and luxe. I went looking for this blood splattered, you know, bedding because I was so attracted to it. Again, in the scene that just became so violent and visceral.
She went and bought that bedspread, remember?
Yeah.
She looked at the tag of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the episode. That's right. You're 100%. She's also a girl who does not mind running up a expense report. Which is a great Villanelle thing. She shops on a lot of people's dimes, which is always fun to watch.
Yes. That's definitely the one I would have said. Then I started thinking, like, just to remember what, I don't want to say this was my favorite, but it was freaking memorable, was the one in the window of the sex club.
Oh, yes, with the naughty husband.
Yes. And all those people watching, thinking it was like performance art, and she like gutted the dude.
Which really tells you something about the Amsterdam red light district, that so many people can just be standing around and be like, oh, look at this performance art where she like, she cuts him from stem to stern, then puts a piggy mask on him while she is wearing a pig mask herself. And it's done in like one of the sex windows in Amsterdam. And it turns out it was the wife. The wife is there watching because she's the one who set it up.
Yeah. Oh, that makes a lot more sense then, because I was really confused about that woman and I was probably looking at my phone and missed something there.
Yeah.
So thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah. He sees her in the crowd and he's like, and that's when he really starts to plead that he's a bad man and he's sick. Before, he's just pleading for help because he realizes this is not the sexual encounter he thought he was getting, because she knew that in her surveillance, this like very humdrum father was into farm animals for whatever reason. So she tempts him by wearing a piggy mask and a short skirt, lures him into the room, basically hangs him upside down like a piece of beef in a locker room. Think like Rocky IV training montage, like hanging beef. Opens up the sex curtain, like slices his stomach from his navel to his chest bone. And in the crowd, he sees his wife as he's like bleeding out and he's pleading to her. And she just kind of stares at him and then walks away without any kind of emotion. Everyone else is watching in like a crowd has gathered because of the quote unquote performance art. But yeah, she's the one who hired him because she realizes that he was a dirtbag husband.
I'll tell you another scene. Now, this isn't a murder scene, but I thought of it earlier when we were talking about the costumes. And then you also asked me about the scenery. Talking about the black humor, and this isn't even like dark. This is just humor. There's the scene. I think she's sitting. I don't remember what city she's in, so I'm guessing she's maybe on like the Seine, and she's wearing pink also. And she was writing thank you, like what looked like thank you notes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they weren't thank you. And a woman comes up and says, "Can I take your picture for Instagram?" And she goes, "No, of course not." And then the woman, and then she goes, "Get a life." And the woman walks away, and they just have this close up on her face, and she goes, "Lame." I watched that scene like 10 times. I laughed so hard at it. As someone who puts a lot of her life on Instagram.
That a very funny scene. You're dead on. And what makes it even better is she's wearing an outfit that screams, put me on Instagram.
Exactly.
She's not wearing some kind of, you know, fade in the background outfit. She was wearing something really kind of that stood out. But the woman interrupted. She was writing a postcard to Eve from the museum she had just visited with Constantine, with the like two women being hung up. It looked like
it was the same episode as the pig.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I think that's maybe what gave her the idea. And yeah, on the back of it, she said, I hope you haven't forgotten about me. And it was kind of like hugs and kisses. She's writing like a postcard. You know, it was almost like a scene of like Sex in the City. Like how Carrie would sit there with her coffee and stare off into the distance before she started typing on her laptop.
No, yeah. She probably would be. No, you know, you're absolutely right that it was like a Sex in the City scene. And Carrie would probably be writing in an actual journal with a real pen. And that's why it really gave off that aura, but whatever, it's not the right word, but you know what I mean? Like it really gave off that feeling because it's exactly what Carrie would do.
I don't know if you watch Westworld, but there's a scene in an earlier Westworld episode this season where Evan Rachel Wood, who plays Dolores Abernathy, she's like one of the leads. She's doing surveillance. She's watching someone and she's like at a rooftop bar. And she's like looking through binoculars and a older like silver fox gentleman kind of starts walking up to her, clearly going to hit on her. She's wearing like a really sleek outfit. She looks really good. And like he gets within like a foot of her. And before he opens her mouth, she like out of the corner of her mouth, she goes, fuck off. And like he just slinks away. I had that total vibe watching the two scenes back together. It was like very much the same kind of thing, you know, it was like lame. You know, or like she screams boring out in the like the museum, you know, and gets hushed by everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, don't hate me for this, but I gave up on Westworld in the middle of season two.
I think a lot of people did. I think a lot of people gave up on Westworld. I've really enjoyed season three. It's much more straightforward, doesn't have the same kind of brain damage requirement to pay attention to every scene like the previous seasons has had. And I think energy wise, it's a lot more like season one. Yeah, I've really enjoyed season three, and I wasn't a huge fan of season two either. I think season three has been a real nice reboot. But yeah, no, season three is worth it, and it has been done in a way where you can kind of just go into it without necessarily watching what came before. So,
okay, all right.
A little side thing. And you can listen to our Pod Clubhouse recaps of it. We talk about it every week.
Alrighty.
Little plug. But I wanted to talk about, just to go back to chemistry one more time and favorite scenes. There is a scene where Villanelle finally crosses a line and comes to Eve's house. Do you remember this from season one where she basically...
When she wanted her to make her dinner?
Yes, the kitchen scene.
Yeah.
And then it ends up in like the bathtub, right? They get kind of chase each other through the thing. Again, very sexual, but also kind of not. And kind of like, am I scared of you or am I turned on by you? And that real chemistry between the two of them. That scene always stood out as a favorite of season one, but I'm bringing it up because I wanted to give you a little trivia.
I like trivia.
That was the scene that Jodie Comer auditioned for when she auditioned for the first audition she did for the role. Sandra Oh had been cast, and about a month later, Jodie Comer was one of like 100 actresses they were reading for the role of Villanelle. The scene that they read together, Sandra Oh and her read that kitchen scene from that episode together, and their chemistry was so palpable in the audition, it helped solidify and got her the role.
Hmm.
And I think if you watch it on screen, I think it is one of the peak moments of their chemistry because they're so close together finally. You know, I feel like they have this electric chemistry from miles apart while they're just playing cat and mouse with each other. When you put them close together, it really kind of sizzles and crackles. So it's pretty interesting. The last thing before we wrap up is this important to you? This show came out really kind of the height of like the Me Too movement. It was part of a real resurgence in strong female leads and a real push for female writers and female creatives. And so, like I mentioned before, Phoebe Waller-Bridge created the show. She adapted it for television. But since then, every year, she has handed the reins each season to a new head writer / showrunner. And they've all been women by design. So she was the head writer, showrunner in season one. Emerald Fennell was a season two head writer and showrunner. Suzanne Heathcote is the current season three. And then it's already been announced that Lauren Neal is going to be the season four head writer and showrunner. when you watch as a woman, as a modern woman fully possessed of herself, does that matter to you? Does that make you want to watch a show more or less? Or, hey, just put out a good story. You don't really care if it's a man or a woman.
There has to be a good story and has to be a well-done show for me to watch. Yes. Does it help when I hear that it has female production staff? For sure. Does it make me want to support that show and go out and sing its praises more? Yes, it does. But I'll tell you, I read something and I hadn't noticed it until I read it, which is why we educate ourselves, that you can tell it's written by, that this series is written by a woman or women because it's practical. And it is true. So, and I almost want to go back and watch some scenes after I read this. So it says, like, Villanelle, even though she's, like, dressed all fabulous, doesn't wear high heels. She's got to be able to move. It says she, when she's going to kill someone, she's, and I do remember a few times, she's either, she's wearing a hat or she pulls her hair up into a bun. Like, she does the things that you, as a woman, would have to do in order to be in that scene. And that goes back to, like, when you mentioned James Bond. You know, when James Bond has these villainous women, they're all these, like, sex pots and stuff that they wouldn't even be able to carry off the murder or the whatever crazy act they're doing based on how they're dressed. So I appreciate little things like that. And I think I'm going to notice it more now that I read that, of those little accents of things in scenes that make sense, that a woman wrote it because a woman was thinking, I wouldn't be able to do that wearing that outfit.
That is a great point that I've never really thought about, but I have thought side by side to that, not in the practical sense, but I've thought about the way the show plays the chemistry and the female relationship between Carolyn Martins and Eve, and between, obviously, Eve and Villanelle. If a guy wrote that, if your average screenwriter wrote their story, it would be so over-the-top sexualized as to lose all of the tension. You know, what makes the show crackle a lot for me is it's largely unrequited. It's not consummated. You know, the closest they got really together was in the end of season one, where they laid in the bed for a second, but she ends up stabbing her. If a guy wrote that, you know, there would be breasts hanging out. There would be weird licking and kissing scene. It would be graphically sexual in a way that would diminish the show. And I think what the show does so well.
No, you're absolutely right. And the other thing, as soon as you started saying that, the other thing I thought of, if a man wrote some of these scenes between these women, there would be a lot more feeling of, like, a jealousy and, like, a catfight feel. And there isn't that. And there isn't always that in life either. Women can have normal friendships and it not be either A, a pillow fight, as you were discussing, or right. B, a, I've got to knock you down because I'm jealous that you have this and I don't have it. So you're right. Those things definitely come through in the writing. But like I said, these little things I hadn't noticed, I feel like I will, about the way the scene is set up.
I think that's right. I mean, another great example is they don't really do your expected hysterical female role either. You know, there's a part of season two where Nico, you know, eventually leaves Eve, or says he's leaving, and steps out, and she catches him kind of with a fellow TA or younger teacher. And she doesn't make a scene. Eve doesn't make a scene. She doesn't howl. She doesn't slap him. She just kind of sucks it up, you know, and there's a little bit of it. I did this to myself, but there's also a little bit of, like, sorrow at taking stock of what has happened and how far it's all fallen apart for her. But again, I think a guy writes that, you know, there, you know, someone hands her a drink right before then so she could throw it in his face, or some kind of hysterical female outburst, I think would be kind of expected. And the show doesn't do that. These are just, again, kick-ass women doing their job and going in the world and in control of their emotions. You know, they are not stereotypes of women.
Well, to bring it back around to what we talked about at the beginning of this, of it, you're not thinking of them as women. They just are the character. The way they're reacting to things in a lot of these scenes is as a human being. They're not reacting like a woman. They're not reacting like a man. They're reacting like a human being. And that's how everything should be written, let's be honest.
It should be. And it was a needed thing. People need to see this kind of TV to remind them of that, because we hear the word prestige TV a lot. We hear the word, you know, golden age of drama. And I think a lot of that is true. But we forget the fact that sometimes even great stories aren't telling really believable stories or really human stories. And I think Killing Eve excels because it largely tells very human stories through the eyes of these two women who are trying to figure each other out, trying to figure themselves out, trying to figure out what they want, you know, and how much free will they actually have versus what other people are kind of making them do if they don't even realize maybe they're being made to do it. You know, there's a lot going on in every episode beyond just the maybe spoken dialogue. There's a lot of subtext here, which is the human experience. You know, how much control do you maybe have during the day? Maybe not as much as you think. And I think Eve and Villeneuve both go through it a lot.
Well said.
Thanks. We're up to my favorite part of every Love It or Leave It episode. We're up to the do you love it or do you leave it? So, Danny, do you love Killing Eve or are you going to leave it?
I think I'm just going to give up on it and after season 3, episode 3. I think I'm done there.
You'll be satiated. Be like, I've seen enough. I'm good.
Yeah, no, I obviously love it and I am in for the long haul.
If you were giving the elevator pitch, you're jumping in with your friends, not watching the show, give us the 30-second elevator pitch. How are you selling Killing Eve to your friends?
Oh, I have already done this a few different times. I think what is... when we don't go into all these specifics that we have gone into over the last hour, I think the most interesting thing about this show is that everyone will like it. Just like we said, that the characters aren't necessarily written as men, women, they're written as humans. It's the same way I feel about watching the show. Mm-hmm. I think men enjoy the show, women enjoy the show. People who like mysteries and, you know, spy thrillers will like it. People who don't even really care that much about spy killers could also like it. It reminds me a lot of a show like 24 or Homeland or Alias, where both men and women can sit down and watch this show together and both enjoy it and both get something out of it.
Like I said, I've watched the show since the very first episode aired, and I've never thought to myself, man, look at me being so woke watching this chick flick. You know, like it's never even entered my head. It's just great drama. It's just a great spy thriller, but it's just great storytelling. So obviously I love it for all the reasons we've said. I think my elevator pitch is two really strong characters, really well-drawn characters who interact with a palpable tension and this magnetic kind of force that pushes and pulls, and just the decisions they make and the way they conduct themselves and just the way the story is drawn takes you through a season. You know, it's a very bingeable show, which is a compliment. You really don't want to wait. You want to see what happens next because the show just propels you forward. Not a lot of downtime, not a lot of quiet moments, not a lot of sleepy time moments where you're going to go reach for your phone. The show easily keeps you engaged through an 8-hour season or however long, 16. Well, I guess they've had like 18 hours now that they've aired. It really just keeps you moving along. And I don't know, especially in this time of quarantine, that you can ask for anything more than that. You know, if you're going to be watching something, you should be watching this show because like Danny said, it appeals across all the lines. No matter what your interest is, as long as you can handle some blood and violence. If you're good with blood and violence, the show is otherwise for you. If you're not good with blood and violence, and it's not like Saw violence where it's like mean-spirited, it's just violent. It's, you know, Villanelle is a very creative and
she's a very loving killer.
She is, but she's like, you know, she's like an artist with her kills. You know, she just doesn't walk up and shoot you. She just doesn't walk up and stab you and then walk away. It's a production. She is a performance artist murderer. So even if maybe you're not crazy about violence and blood, you can probably still appreciate the humor, the dark humor of it all, and the artistry of it all, because it's never boring. She's never boring, you know, which is a favorite word of hers.
Lame.
Yeah, no, the show just sucks you in. It's got great humor. It's really well written. It's really well acted. Great production values. And yeah, it's classic British TV on American television sets. You can watch Killing Eve, actually, season 1 and 2. You can actually binge them on Hulu for free. And season 3 is currently airing on BBC, America, and AMC. Or check your local listings. Those episodes you can watch online if you have a login, if you have a cable login. But, you know, if you're looking just to catch up with the show, season 1 and 2, go right to Hulu. You can watch all 16 episodes right now. Danny, thank you so much for coming out and talking with us today. I love having you over at the Clubhouse.
Thank you so much for having me.
I can't wait till you pick up the next show and we get to do this all over again. So, but, you know, that may be happening sooner than you think. that we actually may be doing another show very, very shortly together. I think in 3 days.
Yep. I got some watching to do.
I just started it today. We're not going to say what it is, but I just started it today. But yeah, so guys, thank you so much for listening to Pod Clubhouse. This has been Love It or Leave It, the podcast, a Pod Clubhouse original, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.
Pod Clubhouse.